From Michigan Radio, I'm Cynthia Canty with a State of Opportunity special report, Waiting for Change, stories from America's broken immigration system.
The assumptions that people have, for example, if you marry a U.S. citizen or have a U.S. citizen child, there will be a path for you to legalize your status, and that's just not the case.
The undocumented worker and her hopes.
We are not here to freeload off of the United States. We are simply here to live, have that American dream.
Workers that are here in our communities and they're in every fabric of our society, you can't really go a single day without encountering one of them, although you wouldn't know it because they're living under the radar.
And the CEO forced to look overseas to fill high-skilled jobs.
So it's not that, you know, you're coming and taking away the jobs. You are trying to fill a gap that exists that nobody is able to fill.
Those stories and more, but first, the news. Welcome to this State of Opportunity special, Waiting for Change. I'm Cynthia Canty. Politicians proclaim it. People argue about it. We hear it so often. Our immigration system is broken.
We have to finally, once and for all, fix our immigration system.
The problem of border security, internal enforcement.
Our immigration system is broken, and everybody knows it.
The U.S. immigration system is a web of policies. It's complex and it's confusing. Policies that touch everyone from a migrant farm worker to an international PhD student. But it's not just the immigrants coming here affected. We all are. These policies touch how much we pay for produce or a meal out on the town, who our neighbors are, and whether Michigan's small businesses can find enough talent to grow. For years now, lawmakers from both sides of the aisle have called for an overhaul of our immigration system. But nobody can agree on just what those changes should look like, especially when it comes to the 11 million undocumented immigrants living right now in this country. Think about that. That's about one in every 30 people. If you don't have papers, the outcome of this sharp political debate has deeply personal consequences. Susan Reed sees this play out every single day in the lives of undocumented immigrants and their families. She's the managing attorney at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. Susan Reed, welcome.
Thank you so much.
When you hear someone say, our immigration system is broken, what does that mean to you?
It means so many things in the lives of the clients that we see every day around the state. But the sharpest focus for me is always parents of U.S. citizen children, families who are here, who have no way to move forward with legal status. So many assumptions that people have. For example, if you marry a U.S. citizen or have a U.S. citizen child, there will be a path for you to legalize your status. And that's just not the case in our current system.
What discretion does Immigration and Customs Enforcement, does the federal government have in deciding whom to single out for deportation?
In terms of an individual family, there's a significant amount of discretion in terms of who is ultimately removed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Immigration judges do not have a lot of discretion. And in fact, the whole arc of the immigration law, particularly since 1996, very harsh measures enacted, signed into law by President Clinton in 1996, were really designed to strip immigration judges of their discretion.
And then you see the effect of what happens when a deportation order is handed down to a parent who has a child with U.S. citizenship or permanent residency.
You know, the parents of U.S. citizen children are deported every day. You know, I feel like that's another sort of myth we encounter that, well, you won't actually be deported if you've been a good person and you have a child. That's just not the law and not the practice. That is the kind of relief that the president was attempting in his 2014 executive actions to provide. We see families struggling every day with decisions about whether to take children with them to an uncertain or violent home country situation, whether to leave children, you know, in the care of friends or relatives, or even in the care of the state. So those are real decisions that Michigan families are facing every day.
And as you referenced, Susan, President Obama has stepped in with executive orders in 2012, the order that would allow some undocumented immigrants who were brought to this country as children to avoid deportation, the DACA or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And then there was that executive order in 2014, DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents. What did those change? And of course, as you say, this past June, that split decision by the U.S. Supreme Court
essentially blocked DAPA from moving forward. But what did they change, especially DACA, for undocumented immigrants in Michigan?
DACA is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, such an example of how ready, willing, and able non-citizens who don't have immigration status are to fully integrate and fully participate in our communities. About 7,000 young people in Michigan came forward starting in June 2012 to apply for the DACA program, and so many of those folks are really moving forward with their lives, which were on hold after they graduated from high school without immigration status, without the legal right to work, without access to scholarships and financial aid, which, by the way, continues to be true. Young people with DACA are still excluded from the whole financial aid system. They're totally excluded from the Affordable Care Act. We do see those young people struggling, but we see all around the state tremendous stories of leadership, of scholarship, of engagement with employers. Those young people with DACA have really had the chance to access driver's licenses, to have the legal right to work, to really participate fully. The DAPA program, we think, would have done the same thing. My daughter attends El Sol, which is a bilingual elementary school here in Kalamazoo, and many parents find themselves just longing to be more integrated, to be more involved, engaged in their community, but live with a lot of fear and anxiety. When school had career day, kids and parents had to be really reassured that the police and firefighters who were there to share their careers weren't there to break up families. I spoke personally with children who had those anxieties seeing law enforcement.
And with DAPA blocked by that Supreme Court decision, what do you see happening now?
That was a very devastating blow to those of us who saw a light at the end of this long tunnel of families struggling with this system. The folks who are community leaders are going to continue to advocate, are going to continue to bring forward stories and tell stories. There's so many community leaders who've really come forward to say, you know, we're undocumented and we're unafraid. We really need to come out as undocumented despite the risks. People need to know us. People need to not let a caricature of who we are be the image, be the dominant theme. And I've been just stunned by the courage of a lot of young people, young parents who are telling their stories. But I think it's easier for folks who don't have children. That's a tremendous risk to take for people who have children. We're still hopeful. We still believe in the goodness of this country and what it has to offer. And we're going to keep working for justice for families.
You know, there are a lot of Americans who say, in essence, look, I don't think we should ban immigrants from coming here, but we have a system. We have a law for people to follow. My grandfather followed the law. My husband did, coming as immigrants, following the rules. And if people come here without legal status, then they're essentially cutting the line. How do you answer that argument, Susan?
For so many people, there is no line to get in. And we had an economic policy through the 90s that essentially sort of left the back door to the country open while people flowed in response to supply and demand in the economy. And there was not a legal way to come. There was not a line to get in. There is not an opportunity for a farm worker in Michoacan whose cousin harvests asparagus in Michigan to apply for some kind of visa to come and do that. We could go into some detail about the H-2A guest worker program, but generally, most of the folks who came here were really coming to respond to an economic reality and also escape a negative economic reality. But they weren't cutting in a line. There wasn't a line to get in. And certainly many immigrants have, in the family-based immigration system, chosen or been able to wait for decades for visas to be available. And I can understand a feeling that, well, someone who didn't wait, you know, shouldn't benefit in any way. That's an incredibly harsh approach to take, given the real dynamic that has pushed people from certain countries and pulled them to ours, and the real contributions. People have subsidized whole industries with low-wage work. Many Americans have reaped many benefits from the economic participation of undocumented immigrants. And just to take an approach that believes that in some past time when really, if you showed up at the front door of the country, you entered in. I mean, when I hear that my grandfather came legally, I think people who say that know very little about what the process looked like when their grandfather came, and even less about what the process looks like today.
Susan Reed with the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. Susan, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Javier Solorzano was 13 when his mother was sent back to Mexico. Shortly after that, his two brothers were also deported. Javier was left without any family in the U.S., so he moved in with his best friend until he graduated high school in Monroe and then went off to college. We asked Javier to reflect on the challenges of being separated from his family and how that has shaped the person he is today.
When I was younger, I knew there was something different about us, and I knew there was always the conversation about having papers, right? It's having papeles or tienes papeles, which means, you know, are you documented, right? I actually lived in apartments where most of the Latino people in Monroe live, and the Border Patrol would wait outside the apartments at 6, 7 in the morning, or even at night when they're coming home to basically take them there before they go to work or after they get back from work. When my mother, my ex-stepdad, and me applied to become permanent residents, everything was flowing well up until the interview date. When my mom crossed the border undocumented, she stayed in the U.S. for a certain amount of years. That enforced her to kind of have to be pardoned to be eligible to become a resident. The pardon could be either from a month or either 3 months to 10 years. My mom said, I want you to think about this, and I want you to tell me what you want to do. You know, at 13 years old, I didn't really have much, but she kind of put the options in front of me. She said, this is what you will get in Mexico, this is what you'll get in the U.S., and, you know, she somehow made me realize the importance of education and why I should continue my education here in the U.S. I spoke with my mom about once or twice a week on the phone. I would sometimes tell her, like, Mom, I don't know if this is worth it. I just want to leave. I want to be with my family. I just want to be normal. Like, why did these things happen to me? Why do I have to go through all of these things? Why me? You know, and she says, I have no idea. I can't answer that, but I can tell you that all of these things that you're going through are making you a stronger person. God told me she's going to be here and she's going to see you graduate, and I just knew God was going to be there. Like, he's the one who made this happen. For the first time in over 10 years, I was able to wake up and say, Mom, what do you want to do today? And for you to say, Mom, what do you want to do today? It sounds so easy, right? But I couldn't do that for the past 10 years. I've always had to say, what am I going to do today by myself?
Javier Solorzano graduated from the University of Michigan this past spring. He'll start his master's in higher education at U of M in the fall. Coming up next, think you don't encounter undocumented workers? Think again.
You can't really go a single day without encountering one of them, although you wouldn't know it because they're living under the radar.
You're listening to Waiting for Change, a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Waiting for Change, a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Undocumented immigrants perform a lot of labor in this country. It usually happens out of sight and out of mind, in farm fields, on construction sites, in restaurant kitchens. But on rare occasions, we get a glimpse into that hidden world. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reports on a recent tragedy that provided just that kind of rare look.
The time, the last day of January 2016, around 9:30 in the morning. The place was a quiet upscale subdivision in Novi, a suburban community west of Detroit.
911, what's the exact location of your emergency? Hello, 911.
Hey, my house, I have fire.
My house is on fire. The man you hear talking there is Roger Tam. He's the owner of the home on Mystic Forest Drive. Tam is a naturalized American citizen from Hong Kong. At times, he and the dispatcher struggle to communicate.
From where?
No,
sir, where are the flames at?
On the basement.
Okay. Are you able to get everybody out of the house?
Yes.
But that wasn't true. In fact, there were 5 young men trapped in that basement. The oldest was 23, the youngest just 16. They were all undocumented, all from Mexico. They all worked in the kitchen of Tam's Novi restaurant, Kim's Garden. And they all died in that fire. A federal grand jury indicted Tam and his wife on charges of harboring illegal aliens. And some began to wonder aloud if something bigger wasn't going on. The case bears some hallmarks of what's called labor trafficking. That's where undocumented workers are exploited through some combination of force, fraud, or coercion. But Raymond Kassar, Tam's defense attorney, says it wasn't that way at all.
So they were able to find Mr. Tam, and Mr. Tam was employing them. He paid them a very, very fair wage. They lived in his house, and he treated them like family.
Kassar won't reveal what that very fair wage is for now, but information in court filings suggests that Tam's undocumented kitchen workers were paid about $2,000 a month, and they worked for about 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. Kassar says two of the young men had worked with Tam for a while, with one even acting as his caretaker. The others had just arrived to work for the Chinese New Year. Kassar says living in Tam's home wasn't a condition of employment.
Mr. Tam simply gave them an option. Hey, if you don't have a place to live, you can stay in my house until you find a place to live. And it was a Novi home. It wasn't some slum.
This living arrangement isn't typical for undocumented workers, according to people familiar with that community in Metro Detroit. It raises some red flags, but it's still unclear how these young men entered the country and how exactly they found Tam. The fire itself was ruled accidental, likely caused by careless smoking. But the government is going after Tam hard, and that's frustrating to people like Bridget Carr, who runs the human trafficking clinic at the University of Michigan. Carr says she's put together lots of cases with clear evidence of workers being exploited, even enslaved, and those went nowhere.
I have been extremely frustrated with our absolute inability to get prosecutors interested in the labor trafficking cases.
Carr says prosecutors seem to prefer cases that involve sex trafficking or that have some high-profile angle, like a multi-state smuggling ring or maybe a tragic ending like this fire. But Carr says regardless, it's all part of the same larger system, one that we're all complicit in to one degree or another.
With one side of our mouth say, stay out, we are not going to give you visas. But the other side of our mouths, we say, here's a job for you, and they'll pay you under the table.
Right now, the Tam case is stalled over a key question. Can Tam and his wife be held responsible for these young men's deaths? But there's a bigger question about our collective responsibility. We all know that undocumented workers do much of the behind-the-scenes work that keeps things running. But we often choose not to see it, except when something terrible happens, and then we have to. I'm Sarah Swick.
The tragedy of those five young restaurant workers from Mexico is a stark reminder. You are likely meeting undocumented workers constantly as you go through your day. That waiter who pours your coffee, the young man who cuts your lawn, the woman who does your nails, the farm worker, the construction worker, the list goes on. Teresa Hendricks is with Migrant Legal Aid based in Grand Rapids, where she's director and senior litigator. Teresa, welcome.
Thank you.
We have heard, Teresa, from politicians and elected officials for years now talking about how our immigration system is broken. In your view, what does a broken immigration system mean?
The broken immigration system starts with the undocumented workers that are here in our communities and they're in every fabric of our society. You can't really go a single day without encountering one of them, although you wouldn't know it because they're living under the radar. They have no path to legalization right now because there is no, as you would imagine, a line that they could sign up for to wait to become legal. They have to have some special category or qualify for some special visa in order to become lawful here. And then on top of that, you have farmers who need workers to come here and harvest the crops so that they don't rot in the fields, and they have a difficult time getting workers to do that. They say that they can't get local folks to do it. So we have U.S.-based people from other countries that want the work and that have to do it under this wink and a nod system where they pretend that they're authorized to work and the employers pretend that they're authorized to hire them just so they can get the crops out.
I love the way you put that, a wink and a nod system. And when we hear national discourse about, quote, illegal immigration, a lot of that is about individuals crossing the border when they shouldn't. But what we don't talk about, or a lot less, are U.S. employers hiring undocumented workers, as you say, relying on them to meet their bottom line. What role do you think American employers play in the number of undocumented workers that we have in this country?
Companies that use labor, particularly low-skilled labor, already have an understanding of how much we need to reform our immigration system because they can't do their work without the immigrant labor. And so they really have to rally around their own political interests to make sure that we can find a path to legalization. They're the first ones that will be able to explain why they hire immigrant labor and why they constantly worried about whether or not their labor force is lawfully present or it's lawfully able to work. So the further out that you get from the situation where the companies are employing that kind of labor, the less understanding you get for the need for immigration reform.
Why do you think that the employer role doesn't get as much attention as the other side of the coin, the people coming here?
It's easier to focus on the immigrant worker having done something wrong by working undocumented. What's less clear is the culpability of the employer, because the employer is not wanting to hire somebody that's undocumented, typically. It's they're forced to because of the market situation. So where our immigration system is broken, it leaves the market, which is the labor supply, ahead of where our regulations are, and they have to continue to do what is necessary in order to get their businesses moving and keep profits coming in. So the employers aren't typically the focus because they can hide behind the I-9 procedure, which is a federal procedure set up for when you're hiring somebody. And the way that it's set up, it's created so that the employer doesn't have to be an expert at examining documents. They just have to accept documents that are, quote, reasonably genuine.
We do hear so much talk about migrant agricultural workers, but give us an idea, Teresa, what parts of our economy are also very reliant on migrant and foreign workers?
You'll find a lot of immigrant workers in the hospitality industries, hotel, restaurants, the construction trades, drywall, carpenter, painting, in factories. You'll find them in landscaping. A lot of the migrants start out harvesting crops, and then as they acclimate and become more integrated into their communities, they will go into other trades and other jobs. And a lot of them actually go into owning businesses and running businesses, cleaning businesses, restaurants, and things of that nature.
And so how would it be different for everyday Americans if these people were not here to do these jobs? I mean, what would our economy look like without them?
Well, that's interesting, because there was a movie made called A Day Without a Mexican. It was done in California. And literally business would stop. I mean, we wouldn't have hotel rooms cleaned, you know, to get the next guest in. Our dinners wouldn't come out on time at a restaurant. We wouldn't have the fresh fruit in the supermarkets like we have. It would be nearly impossible to thrive without the immigrant labor here.
We're talking with Teresa Hendricks of Migrant Legal Aid. They're based in Grand Rapids. Give us an idea of what life is like for these workers that we're talking about. What is it like day to day with their legal situation?
We deal with mixed families, meaning that some of the family members are lawfully here and some are not. And it's very trying for the families, because a trip to the grocery store for a mixed family could result in absolute tragedy if they are to get pulled over and a police officer starts to ask about immigration status. They can be deported and separated from their families. So we have sometimes a mother from Guatemala, a father from Mexico, both undocumented, and the children are from the United States. And they live in constant fear of that tap on the door where somebody's going to start asking that question. So they have to figure out a way to live under the radar without causing any problems, without drawing any attention to themselves, but able to earn a living and go to school and fit in with society as best they can.
In the immigration debate, Teresa, a lot of the conversation is dominated by migrant and undocumented workers, but there are challenges for high-skilled foreign workers as well. What do you see? In what ways are their experiences related?
Well, the higher-skilled workers would be here on a special visa, an H-1B, for example, and they have their own set of issues that they have to deal with. The employer has to prove that they looked for an American, a U.S. citizen, or authorized worker here in that same skill set, and that they couldn't find one.
From engineers to farm workers, we're talking about jobs that could be performed by Americans. Are all of these undocumented workers taking our citizens' jobs?
No. You can ask any employer, whether they're a grower, agricultural employer, or a factory owner, or a hotel or restaurant owner, if they can get local folks to do the jobs and to stick with the jobs. And every single time you will hear that they cannot get local folks to do it. Back in the day, people relied on college kids, you know, during the summer, and that's just not the case anymore.
So truly, if there's an argument that they're taking jobs away from Americans, you're saying no, ask employers and you're going to hear a different story.
That's right. Ask the very people who are doing the hiring, if that's the case, and you'll find out that they're not taking any jobs away from any Americans.
This is a complex issue, and there's certainly no silver bullet solution to the problem. But what do you think the priority should be to get us on the path to fixing our broken immigration system?
We had a perfect solution in place, and it got derailed right around the time of 9/11. And it was called the Ag Jobs Bill. And it was a federal bill that was meant to allow the undocumented population working in agriculture to slowly find a path to legalization by working, continuing to work in agriculture over a period of years, up to, you know, 5 or 8 years. And they could earn the way to become legal. That meant that there was no floodgates that would open. People couldn't just come from nowhere and start working in agriculture. And it meant that people that had given their lives to agriculture could find a light at the end of the tunnel and become legal. At the same time, it reduced the bureaucratic burden on growers when they wanted to bring over foreign guest workers under the H-2A program.
And that was derailed and never picked up again after 9/11?
That was never picked up again. That's very unfortunate because that is the solution. It was a very bipartisan effort, and both sides gave a lot and compromised and got as much as they could. And we really need to bring that back. We need to give agriculture a boost and an ability to allow their workers to legalize.
What could fixing our immigration system mean for our nation?
Well, we have 11 million undocumented workers. Right now, they're all paying into the Social Security Suspense Fund. It's about $50 billion a year that they put into that fund. They're never going to get back out. They're paying taxes using the ITIN numbers, which is the Individual Taxpayer Identification Number. Our government knows that we have undocumented workers. They're taking their money. They're giving them a tax ID number so that they can pay taxes even though they're undocumented. So they have to eventually acknowledge that they're part of our society, they're part of the workforce, and that they're the necessary group to contribute to the ongoing strength of our Social Security system and to other people's future retirement. We need to keep our workforce active and working in order to pay for the retiring people.
Teresa Hendricks is with Migrant Legal Aid. Teresa, we want to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
As they hide in plain sight, working among us and living alongside us, yet fearing the traffic stop or the tip-off that could tear their families apart, there is much these undocumented workers want to say to us if they had the chance. Meet Blanca. She grew up poor in Argentina and came to the U.S. in search of work when she was 17. She's now 30, lives in West Michigan, and is the mother of 4 children. Since coming here, she's worked on farms, cleaned homes and offices, and worked in sales.
When I first came to the United States, I had to work picking strawberries, picking apples. We worked long hours. We worked heavy loads. And there was still no sadness, no anger in the fields. We were happy just because we are able to work. We are not here to steal anyone's jobs. We are not here to get Medicaid, food stamps, you know, cash assistance, any assistance that others are entitled to as being an American citizen. We are not here to freeload off of the United States. We are simply here to live, have that American dream, have our children have the education that in other countries they would not be able to have. I am able to work illegally. I do pay my taxes. But at the end of the year, I do not get my taxes given back to me. I live scared because of the police officers. If you are going 5 over the limit of the speed, they'll pull you over. If you have a busted tail light, they can pull you over. Or if the license plates are out, they can pull you over. And by not being able to have a driver's license in Michigan, they can arrest you for not having a driver's license. And then take me to jail, and then by that going to jail, they'll run my name, run my papers, and then I'm going back to Argentina where I'll leave my 4 little boys all by themselves here. So I have 4 children. My 2-year-old was born preemie, and he is on the liver transplant list. So if I leave, if I get deported, a lot of Americans say, well, you can take your children back with you. But in a country where we don't have the freedom of insurance, we don't have good medical techniques, we don't have anything that are stability for a child who is on a transplant list, he would not have a fighting chance if we had to go back to Argentina. Having a green card to me would be a stability of knowing that I'm not going to be scared of if I get pulled over by a police officer for not having a seatbelt, or if I'm having to call the police for a civil matter such as them come to my house for a fire, or if I need medical assistance. Having that well-being of knowing that they're not going to ask me about, do you have a green card? Do you have legal status? And to be able to fulfill my life here in the United States, to further my education, have the right to legally vote for our presidents, for our city council, for congressmen, and what have you. They make it so hard for immigrants to have a permission, you know, their papers to come here and work. But yet, how do they expect us to do it legally when it's so hard? It's jumping through hoops, jumping through fire, just to even do things the legal way. I had to take matters into my own hands, yes. If I could do it the other way, I wish I could, but if I had to do it again, with the way things are now, I would still have to come here illegally.
Coming up next, it's not only restaurant owners and farmers relying on foreign-born workers. CEOs are looking overseas for workers to fill high-skilled STEM jobs.
And that's what America is known for. We are the land of immigrants. And so we brought the best and the brightest to work on these areas and to rev up the economies.
You're listening to Waiting for Change, a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Waiting for Change, a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. Much of our national debate about immigration reform focuses on unskilled foreign-born workers. But there is another side. The highly skilled workers with the knowledge that businesses so badly need, technical, engineering, science, mathematics. Tel Ganeshan is the CEO and president of Kaiba Incorporated. It's an engineering services and software product company based in Farmington Hills. Tel believes that national policies on immigration must change if we want to hold on to our place as an industrial superpower. Tel, spell out the problem that you and other employers face.
Right now, I think we are at a war for, you know, talent, right? And so we're not finding enough people that could do the jobs. And so that's a huge challenge that we all have.
And what kind of fields are we talking about?
We're talking, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math. Basically anything to do with computer science, engineering, information system, those kind of jobs.
And so when you're saying we're not finding enough people, you're meaning the U.S.-born.
Yes.
Graduate, somebody gets out of college,
yes,
is looking for a job. And why is that?
So the reason is that the economy is producing more jobs in those areas than what we are outputting from the colleges. So if you really look at, you know, the last 3-4 decades, the number of enrollment in those STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, math, they have calmed down. But then the economy is producing, you know, from out of manufacturing, now we moved into digital economy. And if you really look at the state, now we are moving into connected cars and autonomous vehicle. So the economy is constantly changing, but our education system is not producing enough graduates in line with what the economy, where it is trending. And that, because of which, the gap continues to widen.
So the answer for companies across the nation is to look overseas and bring in workers from other countries.
I mean, the solution to that is twofold. So the near term is that we cannot, you know, produce engineers today. We got to work the system. So therefore, the near term is to, you know, bring the best of the best wherever they are. And that's what America is known for. We are the land of immigrants. And so we brought the best and the brightest to work on these areas and to rev up the economy. So that's what we need to do in the short term. In the long term, we got to focus on how do we, you know, motivate our kids to pursue science, technology, engineering, and math so that we produce more than what the economy is looking for.
Tel, when you're looking for someone to fill a job opening, how hard do you look for American employees, American-born employees? What's that process like?
So, I mean, most of the companies, we look for U.S.-born citizens, right? So it's not that our goal is to go and hire people from outside the U.S. because, you know, with outside the U.S., it's a very long process. We don't want to – no employer wants to go through that. So the problem is if they're a U.S.-born, they're already picked up by major corporations. So it's not that they don't have jobs. Anybody who is a STEM educated, U.S.-born, they already have multiple jobs. right? So it's not that you're trying to displace them. So the issue that we face, you know, whatever we are hearing, is really people who don't have the right degree but want to pursue in them, and they may complain, and that is one of the issues that we are seeing. So it is only those situations. In fact, we go to almost all schools in the state of Michigan, and we go around the country to recruit people to keep the pipeline going. And we are not finding them enough. And they're already picked up on, you know, on-campus job interviews, so we don't find anybody. And so that's the challenge that we are facing. So we try every attempt to hire a U.S.-born worker. In fact, our workforce is almost 90% of them are U.S.-born citizens and permanent residents of this country.
What's the process, Tell, that you as an employer need to go through? Let's say you've got, I'm just going to pick a number out of the air, you have five engineering jobs you need to fill. You've looked around, cannot find U.S.-born candidates. What do you have to go through to look outside of the U.S.?
You know, we have to recruit them. And to recruit them, you know, we have to go through a very rigorous process with the UICIS, you know, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. And you pay, you know, anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 per person and process the paperwork. And you have to plan about 5-6 months ahead of the, you know, when you want to bring them on board. And that too, you got to, with the way the there's a lottery system. And right now, your odds of getting one is only 30%.
And this is the H-1B visa we're
talking about. I'm talking about the H-1B visa. In particular, this highly skilled non-immigrant visa that we utilize to fill the gap.
So you're planning ahead. Your candidate, meantime, is kind of in limbo.
Yes.
Waiting to see if they wind up getting picked.
Yes. And the company, you know, and the things changes in business. And things changes. It's such a dynamic state. But then we assume everything is so static, and we are working with an archaic process with the government.
And we know that last year there were 65,000 foreign-born workers allowed to enter the country and work through this H-1B visa. So every submission is tied to a specific available job. And yet there were more than 170,000 jobs that needed to be filled, but there just weren't enough workers. So
what does
it cost you? As an employer, you're speaking for the other employers that are going through this. What does it cost you when a job goes unfilled?
You know, we don't improve the top line. We don't improve the bottom line. And then, you know, we continue to be, we're not able to grow. So had we gotten those kind of resources, then probably we would have increased our bottom line or the growth rate by another few percentage points. And then they all add up collectively to the companies and collectively to the U.S. economy.
Because it strikes me, I can imagine that one foreign-born engineer could create something that could then in turn wind up creating American jobs?
Oh, absolutely. It has all a trickle-down effect. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a lot of stats out there. I think, you know, every one H-1B worker being hired, we end up creating two other or three jobs for the local bond, right? So it's not that this, you know, you're coming and taking away the jobs. You are trying to fill a gap that exists that nobody is able to fill.
Now, there have been some highly publicized cases of abuse of the H-1B program. I'll point to the most notable one, which was the Walt Disney Corporation,
sure,
where 250 American IT professionals at Walt Disney World had to train their replacements from India, and then they were laid off. How would you change America's immigration system to help fill the talent gap but prevent the kind of abuse that we saw at Walt Disney World?
Yes, as with anything else, Cynthia, you know, you would have these kind of abuses. And we need to, you know, have some measures to prevent those kind of abuses. Just because you have abuses in isolated cases, you cannot go down and cripple down the whole process.
Tell Gunnation is the CEO and the president of Kaiba Incorporated, an engineering services and software product company based in Farmington Hills. Thank you so much for being with us and bringing your insights as a CEO to our special today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Cynthia.
The lottery system that allows only a limited number of foreign workers to get that coveted H-1B visa is a problem for employers like Tell and hopeful college graduates like Nahal. Originally from India, he graduated this past May from the University of Michigan, Dearborn, with his master's degree in automotive systems engineering. He came here to study on a student visa, also known as an F-1 visa.
Now he has a week to find a job or he'll have to go back to India.
So I was counting on this job offer at one of the big three companies. So I applied directly. I got a call. I got interviewed. And then they were impressed with my qualifications. So then they decided that they wanted to hire me. And they did. And then I got the offer letter. But then they didn't ask me, like, and I didn't tell that I'm an international student and I'm on F1 visa. And then I would need visa sponsorship at some point of time. But then it came down to it, so I did tell them, and then they cancelled on me. So they cancelled the offer. And I was counting on them, and then I thought, like, I'm safe now. But then all of a sudden, they decided to cancel on me, and then here I am left with 1 week, and then with no other options or very few. I lost an opportunity, right? I wanted to do that. It was, like, inclined to what I would like to do, but then I couldn't do it. So this was not the first time even I have this happened to me before as well, you know, one time with another Asian employer that's again a big player here in the automotive industry. I got a call from them. Again, I told them I'm an F1. They said again, we can't do it. We just won't be able to do the visa sponsorship for you. And then again, another major supplier, same thing. They emailed me back asking, like, what's your visa status? I replied saying I'm an F1 international student. F1 visa holder, again, they didn't even get back to me. So 3 or 4 times. And then, you know, another reason that they wouldn't want to sponsor me is because even if they file for sponsorship, okay, there is again this lottery draw thing in H1B. So even the employer is not sure, neither I am sure that I will be picked up in the lottery. So I know many people who get picked up, but there are people who don't get picked up. So again, the employer will lose their employees, right, that they have invested a lot of money on. So I have until like 15th August, and then maybe if I'm not able to find a job or anything in those time, I'll have to leave the country. I don't have much time left. I have like a week left. I'm very confident about my abilities. Like after 3-4 years, I plan to become a successful engineer, you know, like working on vehicle programs, helping to build like future-ready vehicle models. We need to put our voices out, right, so that the U.S. government, the USCIS, the Customs and Immigration Department will hear us, and then they would realize what difficulties the students will face, and then they would, you know, implement something to help us.
For undocumented immigrants, sure, the ability to work is important, but so is the broader opportunity to build a life with your family. That's where DACA and DAPA come in. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, is President Obama's 2012 executive order aimed at the Dreamers, the undocumented immigrants who were brought to this country before their 16th birthday. Some 700,000 young people are now on the DACA rolls, protected from deportation. DAPA would have extended that protection to parents. But this past June, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked President Obama's plan to expand DACA and add DAPA. Here's immigration attorney Susan Reed again.
DACA is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, such an example of how ready, willing, and able non-citizens who don't have immigration status are to fully integrate and fully participate in our communities. About 7,000 young people in Michigan came forward starting in June 2012 to apply for the DACA program, and so many of those folks are really moving forward with their lives, which were on hold after they graduated from high school without immigration status, without the legal right to work. We see all around the state tremendous stories of leadership, of scholarship, of engagement with employers. Those young people with DACA have really had the chance to access driver's licenses, to have the legal right to work, to really participate fully to their full capacity, although, again, still enjoying diminished rights compared to other immigrants and compared to citizens. The DAPA program, we think, would have done the same thing for so many of our communities. And many parents find themselves in this situation and are just longing to be more integrated, to be more involved, engaged in their community, but live with a lot of fear and anxiety.
Two young immigrants in Michigan who are caught in this stalemate are Daniel and Sandy. Daniel came to the United States from Guatemala when he was 7. Thanks to DACA, he is now among the 700,000 young people protected from deportation, although some of his family are not protected because DAPA is on hold. And Sandy came here from Guatemala when she was 9. She does not have legal status. So back on June 23rd, the day of the Supreme Court decision, Sandy was left empty-handed. She still can't get a work permit, a driver's license, no legal status. Daniel was in Ann Arbor when the news hit.
I was about to get on the bus, and I saw the organization that I follow on Facebook. Mm-hmm. They went live, and that was frustrating. It was frustrating. It was like, oh, why? You know, I questioned, like, so many questions came up to my mind and so many emotions. It was just a hard day. I remember going back to the office that I work in. I just sat there by myself, and I texted you. I was like, did you see what happened? I felt so horrible about, like, you know, my siblings, my older siblings would have qualified. My mom would have qualified, actually. My friends, you know, mm-hmm. friends like you, friends, I have other friends who would have benefited from the expansion of DACA. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to deal with. And sitting at my work by myself, you know, without talking with someone, it was a lot harder because it's hard to connect in an environment where, like, people don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so hard to talk with them. So I received a text from a friend, and he asked me, how are you holding on, you know? Like, how are you holding on about this? And I'm just like, I'll be fine, you know? It's something that happens, but we got to be hopeful, you know?
Yeah,
it's just all we have left is, like, hope that mm-hmm. something will change soon.
Yeah.
And hopefully it will, you know? Hopefully it will. How about you? When you heard about it, like, how did you feel?
I was really excited, you know? I thought they were going to approve it because they said everything was going good. And I was, like, getting all happy, you know? Yeah, finally I'll be able to get my driver's license and my parents will get a social security too and everything will be good, you know? But when I heard, like, I turned on the TV and I, like, looked at the news and I was just in shock, you know? I was like, what happened? And I just saw people crying, you know? They were, like, really happy about it too, but it didn't pass. And I did cry a little bit because I was just really, I was happy, you know, that it was probably going to happen, but it didn't. So, like, it just went down. But I try to take it in a positive way, you know. Things might change in the future. You never know. And it was a tie, too. Like, you know, it wasn't mm-hmm. like all, they were all against it, you know. It was 4-4, right? So, you know, maybe something's going to happen, you know. We just have to have hope and be positive, you know, things will get better. This is a country where your dreams can come true if you work hard for them, you know, and it's not only us who are fighting for this. Like, it's a lot of people, and they all have the same hope, you know, like, be legal one day.
The outcome of the presidential election in November will be crucial in shaping America's future immigration policies. Yet what either candidate might actually do for the 11 million undocumented immigrants living here remains to be seen. And so, Sandy, Daniel, Blanca, Nahol all continue waiting for change, hoping for a path to legally live in this country, either for themselves or those they love. This has been a State of Opportunity special, Waiting for Change, Stories from America's Broken Immigration System. The executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, and Jody Westrick. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for spending this hour with us.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.